Before I bring Chuck Palahniuk out, I just want to tell you three things. One, if you aren't a member of the Commonwealth Club yet, consider it. I am. It's one of the Bay Area's most prestigious nonprofits, and it can't host events like what you're here for tonight without your support. Two, if you love what you see, hear, and do tonight, check out what else the Commonwealth Club's Inforum has to offer by liking them on Facebook, facebook.com/InforumSF. Three, if you wish you were the one up here asking Chuck Palahniuk questions, I can get you pretty close. There are question cards on each of your seats. Write your name and question on your card. Give that card to a volunteer who will roam the aisles, and I'll do my best to ask your question during the last quarter of the event. If you have bad handwriting like I do, or prefer to type, you can tweet your questions at using @InformSF, and someone else will write down the question for you. So let's get to it. Over the course of, to my count, 14 books, Chuck Palahniuk has created a fictional world all his own. It's edgy and dark and somehow unnervingly familiar. Where most of us turn away, Palahniuk fixes his attention, and he brings his laser intelligence with surprising empathy and not a small amount of formal genius. A friend asked me recently to describe Chuck Palahniuk's work, and I said, imagine taking the spare line-by-line storytelling of Raymond Carver or Amy Hempel, throw in a lacerating send-up of contemporary culture, and run it through the brain of a young and lost soul trolling the streets and a support group or two for connection or a good lay. There are packs a reader strikes with Chuck Palahniuk, and the rewards are manifold. It isn't surprising to me that he's gathered such a cult following over the years. Readers feel, upon leaving his books, as though this is their world, their writer. And because it's hard to adjust their eyes afterwards to the world outside, they dive right back into Chuck Palahniuk's world looking for another fix. His books are reread. Ask the person next to you how many times they've read Fight Club or Choke or Diary or Invisible Monsters. You're likely to get some interesting numbers. With all the success and celebrity Chuck Palahniuk has had, he continues to avoid playing it safe. His rebooting of Invisible Monsters offers many pleasures, and how perfectly subversive that the hardcover has come out so long after the paperback. The planet Brandy Alexander is rendered here, a road story, a reinvention tale, a portrait of America Diane Arbus would have cherished. And above all, like all of Palahniuk's work, it's the voice that hooks you, that dives into your thoughts and dreams if you're unlucky, and stays with you. What a treat it is to introduce Chuck Palahniuk.
Are you done now? So, how many people here, like I can actually see you, have never been to an author event? Boy, that's better. That's better than it usually is. And I'm just fucking with you. So most of you got balloons, right? Okay. The balloons have a purpose. And for the time being, the first thing to see is the clock. The clock, what is a clock? You know, okay, the Rosemary's Baby. Remember the Rosemary's Baby? The clock is 9 months. You got 9 months for this story to wrap up. What is the clock in the Steppert wives? At one point, Joanna Eberhardt realizes, hey, all my friends change into sexy robots after 90 days. So there's got to be a clock in everything or it will go on forever. And our clock is 50 tigers.
Where's the...
50 tigers. So, while Tom dumps out more tigers, when the tigers are gone, we'll be done. And the first question is, I'm going to ask you some questions. If you know the answers, you get a tiger. And if your question that you submit, if Tom asks it, you get a tiger. And at the end, if you don't fuck up your balloon, you might get a tiger. And to see how this works, why do you suppose I use tigers?
Tiger Stripes is the name of the cat in the dam.
She's paying attention. Because Tiger Stripe is the name of the cat in Damned, the last book. So... Tiger. See how easy? More tigers. All right.
That's a lot of tigers.
This is a fraction of the tigers that were in my house. This is why China is kicking our butts. Tom.
How come you get a tiger and I don't?
Because I have nervous, sweaty hands.
Huh? And it is...
Behind you. Bulging curtain.
Pardon? It's behind the curtain.
Behind left.
To your left.
Ah. So, to proceed, so I wanted to talk, Chuck's terrific, the book that's being sold, I think, here is Invisible Monsters Remix, and I wanted you to talk a little bit, I guess, about the history of the book. I know you, originally, it was one of the first books you worked on, and you had troubles selling it. Supposedly, I guess, it was a little bit too violent and intense for people, so you toned down your violent, intense impulses and wrote Fight Club after that. But it was published, and it was originally published as a paperback, and for those who haven't seen the version that's out now, it's been reassembled, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about it. In the introduction, you talk about an aversion or seeing a kind of linear plot as a sort of trap. And even the phenomenon of when you hold a book and you can see that the ending's coming, that you wanted to have the reader sort of avoid that. But if you could talk a little bit, I guess it's a long question, but about the history of this particular book and then what you, when you revisited, the pleasures of revisiting it and making it into something new.
Originally, I wrote that first book that we all more or less write, that book that is 1,800 pages of crap, that is just night after night of people calling saying there's a party you want to go, and you saying, no, I've got to stay home and write crap. And really writing just enormous amounts of it. And then having it rejected completely. And then writing Monsters, I decided, screw it. You know, if nobody's going to publish my stuff, then I should have a great time writing it. I should write a book that is as fun as any party I'd be skipping. And so a lot of Monsters was written at parties, or it was written in very social contexts. And it was a blast to write. But when I took it to market, there was really kind of no cultural precedent for it. The publisher said it would be too hard to find a niche for it. The bookstores wouldn't even know where to shelve it. That it didn't really fit in with any of the existing kind of market identities. And that was their biggest complaint about it. So that's more or less why it died initially. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Well, it was the idea, the remix. Well, first of all, I guess the book operates in many ways with jumps and instructions to the reader. So you finish a chapter, and then you're instructed to jump ahead to chapter 33, or you're instructed to jump ahead to chapter 40, and then you return. But essentially, you're, as the authorial presence, you're creating a kind of roadmap that people can either take or not take. But if you could talk a little bit about the decision to do that, and including some chapters you can't read unless you hold it up to the mirror. There's a couple of them, and that right. was an interesting move as well. So I felt very strange in my house holding up Chuck's book to the mirror, you know, and then reading it.
Or you can read it without the mirror, but you have to read it in an experience that's really similar to how you first read as a child, where you have to sound out and identify every letter. You're not just reading according to patterns, you're reading letter by letter. And there's a kind of sense of victory when you figure out what a word is. And so, in a way, I wanted to
I cheated.
Well, which is perfect. But in a way, I wanted to get back to that sense of reading as that task that has a small difficulty to it, so that there is a sense of ongoing triumph in just being able to understand the story. Especially since it's a story that most people would already know at this point, they would know the main plot. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want to just make it different. I wanted to make it different, add 110 extra pages of kind of backstory and extras to it, and make it difficult. And also dealing with the mechanical aspects of books. You know, people always, they complain to me about page numbers in books and how that kind of gives away that things have got to be coming to a head. Monica Drake, who's a friend of mine who wrote Clown Girl, she says her butt can tell time in the movies. Okay, it's got to be coming up on the second act climax because my butt feels a certain way.
People should hire her for that.
And that's why in Survivor, I ran the page numbers backwards. It just seemed like such a simple way of accelerating a process that people already have. You already know that the book is kind of dwindling to the end because there's only so many pages left. But if you could, you know, moment by moment know exactly how many pages were left because they counted down. And also increasing the kind of mystery factor and sense of discovery that you would get, I used to get with the Sears catalog, where you people have filthy minds. Why does it always fall open to the underwear section? Where with the Sears catalog, there was that sort of happy coincidence or chance that would fall open to an object or items that you'd never seen before. There was always something kind of surprising and charming to find in it. There was never a sense that you knew the entire thing. And so, again, it was restructuring the book the way it was supposed to be originally, was an attempt to make it like those thick catalogs or thick fashion magazines, where no matter how well you thought you knew this thing, when you went to throw it away, it would fall open to something you didn't know. And there would be the sense of it being brand new. So.
In some ways, I'm wondering where you draw your influence from. I mean, you seem very acutely aware of a reader's experience, and that's interesting. And I'm wondering about your own experience of a reader, where you find you're bored or fascinated, whether your methodology as you go into a new book comes from what you looking at books and wanting an experience and not getting it, and therefore moving into a sort of new form, you know, and whether you borrow from film sometimes, you borrow from the Sears catalog in this, but just a way, you know, we talked a little bit earlier, in some of your books you have a novel that's told in epistolary form, another novel that's told in diary form, you know, as you move into each new work, is it a kind of quest for something you haven't experienced as a reader, I guess?
For most of my books, I try to use a nonfiction form, because a nonfiction form comes with its own authority. It allows you to tell a more fantastic story because you're telling it in a form that people associate with the truth. And that's why movies like Citizen Kane is my favorite example. You know, it's presented as a newsreel initially, and as people researching a newsreel. And so they can tell this fantastically melodramatic model and story, but imbue it with a kind of gravitas because of the nonfiction context. And we see it over and over again. We saw it with Blair Witch Project. You can tell a more fantastic story if you use a nonfiction form. And you don't have to reinvent the wheel, because a nonfiction form comes with its own transitions. It has all of that stuff already worked out. How do you get from this thing to this thing? Fight Club wasn't a nonfiction form, so I used choruses for transition. I could go anywhere as long as I came back to the chorus, like in a song. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, nonfiction forms, they give you a gravitas, and they dictate your transitional devices. So that's why I really love those.
Yeah, I was wondering, now you have a background in journalism, and you have a background in it, and then after Fight Club and after some success, you went back to journalism. But I guess at least in this book, we were talking earlier about some of the details of facial reconstruction, you know, for your main character. I learned, for example, that in order to reconstruct a jawline, you can use your shin bone, complete with attached arteries. And then we talked about the soft, cancellous bone pulp from arms and legs that's used. There's a ton of there seems to be some pleasure in the researched elements. There's a pleasure for me as a reader, but I'm wondering about bringing the sort of journalist curiosity into fiction, if you could talk a little bit about that, you know, how that's informed your work. Or maybe it's not a journalist's curiosity, but it's, I guess, you're able to tap into a very particular language, I guess, depending on who your characters are, what particular, there's a whole new world that's opened up, and it's very exact, I think. I'm not sure if that comes, maybe it doesn't come out of journalism, it just comes out of, you know, the particular way you approach it. But it strikes me as that, you know, as your work is very much of the world around us. It's not, you know, something that comes into a sort of hidden away, solitary place. It involves getting out in the world and coming back with stuff, sort of.
And that, you know, that's always been the kind of journalist part of me, is oh, I hate this. I hate personal shit. I've been meeting since 1990 with the same group of writers. And at this point, we meet on Monday nights. And we meet at 7 o'clock and we present our work. And we typically drink, and if somebody has Vicodins. I don't want to make it sound like we're like these drug addicts, but 11 writers, each with a Vicodin. Those are great workshop nights. And we have met now over 20 years. And these are the longest friendships I've ever had. And so I've watched my friends Some of them are now incredibly wealthy from their writing. And we all started as these kids. And some have had wonderful kids, and the kids are married, and they have grandkids now. And one died. Our friend Candy died. Candy was in workshop forever. And I still remember all of Candy's stories, and then Candy got cancer and died. And we held workshop in the hospice when Candy was dying. And I had mentioned something about, you know, my mother died a couple, 3 years ago. And I had mentioned that for the longest time, I could not press 7. I would have all these voicemails from my mother. And it would say, press 7 to erase. Press 9 to save for another so many days. Press 8 to return this call. And I always find myself pressing 9. I could not press 7. And somehow, I mentioned that. And my friend Aaron, who was one of Candy's best friends in workshops, said, I pressed 9 too. She's pressed 9. Candy's been dead 5 years. And Erin Leonard still has Candy's voicemails on her phone. She always presses 9. She always presses 9. She always presses 9. And that's the impulse that got me writing. Is I can't stand that people will tell me things that are so fantastically moving and funny. I can't stand that those things will be forgotten. My friends Tammy and Matthew, they have a cat, Petey. They had this big, huge, fat Maine Coon cat. And Petey had diabetes really bad, and everybody was allergic to Petey. And they decided they're going to have to put Petey down. And when they went to the day that Petey was supposed to die, Matthew walked into the kitchen, and he saw this huge can, this huge bag of cat food. And he thought, we've got all this cat food. That cat's not dying until he eats all this food. I'm not throwing this away. And so Matthew, just, you know, that became the hourglass of Petey's life. We talk about clocks. Next time you see a narrative, say, what is the clock? The clock of Petey's life was that big bag of cat food. But every time I would visit them, they'd still have Petey. And Matthew would take me aside and he would say, it's going to kill Tammy to kill Petey. So I bought another bag. And I keep pouring a little bit in the main bag. And Matthew went to take a leak, and Tammy comes to me, and she goes, it's going to kill Matthew. So, I got a bag. It's in the bedroom closet. And I thought that story was so endearing. I love that story. And eventually, Petey died of natural causes.
At 42.
But people tell you these stories, and they're so fantastically touching and moving, and so there's something about them. I can't stand for them to be lost. So in a way, my writing is a way of trying to quilt together these stories that are each one so special. And sometimes my writing is really terrible. But in a way, it's just this matrix whose only purpose is to preserve things that I think are fantastic.
That's great. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the origins of Fight Club. Now, you were a member of the Cacophony Society, is that correct?
Yeah.
And if you could, if you could talk about your experience in the Cacophony Society and then the emergence of the ideas for Fight Club. I know it started as a short story, is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
It started as on an afternoon at work, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, right after lunch. And I wanted to write a short story, and I wanted to experiment using rules as a transitional device. So I just had to come up with 7 rules. Just arbitrary 7 rules. What if there was a place you could go and get into a fight as casually as you would go ask someone to dance? What would the rules be for that place? And the whole thing was just an experiment in structuring. So, you know, again, so much of my work is just an experiment for creating a context for
the stories that I collect. I'm not so much a painter as I am the person that owns the gallery in which the paintings are exhibited. And I'm trying to ongoingly create a context for preserving things that I collect from other people, that I find, that I really treasure. So I came up with these 7 rules that would allow me to just jump around in time and place and topic, as long as I came back and touched on a rule. And I wrote that story in half an hour. And that became chapter 6 of Fight Club. It was the first short story I ever sold to a magazine. So that was, you know, again, it was just a structuring exercise.
Can you talk a little bit about the process of seeing it moved into film, you know, at all? Or with that, how much of a part of it were you? Did you work on the script? Did you, what did you think of the movie ultimately?
My editor had sat me down really early, and he said, of all the books that are published, 2% are optioned for movies. And of that 2%, only 2% ever go into production. So he said, this is not going to happen, especially not with this book. This will never, ever, ever happen. So I had no expectation. You know, my heart just wasn't there. It really did occur as this thing that I had no attachment to. And so when it did start to happen, it was kind of sweetly absurd, because since the book was based on real things from my life, seeing my friends and so seeing these events recreated on this very grand scale with these very attractive people was kind of shocking and nostalgic, that there was a sweetness there. Like going through a high school annual. There was a sense of kind of distance and loss. So it was very sweet.
And can you talk a little bit about the phenomenon of the sort of popularity of it, and then the sort of, I guess a lot of people have started Fight Clubs, I guess, in the aftermath of it.
And that goes back to the Cacophony Society, because Cacophony was basically an organization of people who had really boring jobs. They were letter carriers for the post office. They were bookstore clerks at Powell's. They were people who had really, you know, very structured hourly job lives. And they needed a way to have chaos in their lives for a very structured, like, window of time. You know, if we do this kind of a theme party, we can be crazy, we can be insane anarchists from 4 o'clock until midnight on Saturday night. And so it was a way of having completely structured chaos in your life and being able to schedule that every week. Kind of an experiential potluck, because people would host it. People would come up with concepts the way you did when you were kids and you would play a game. Okay, the boards are safe, but the ground is lava. So if you touch the ground, and you would do that. You just arbitrarily come up with rules. You know, the first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk. You just come up with a rule and another rule, and you invent the game instantly. And you have the freedom and the authority to do that. And Cacophony let us do that every week and give up our boring lives for, you know, 2 or 3 hours.
And are you still friends with people who were in the Cacophony Society back then?
I am, but we've all gotten old. So now we're these old people who look back on it in boring old ways. But it is this thing that is constantly kind of reinvented. And in a way, one of my favorite writers is a British anthropologist, Victor Turner. And he talks about limnoid events, which are kind of an event where you come together with other people. And sometimes you pay to participate, and sometimes they're free. But they're an event that you come into where the standard rules of society don't apply. And just by entering, there's no social hierarchy. You're equal with everyone. And so in Cacophony, there were things like Santa Rampage, where everyone assumed the name Santa, and everyone dressed as Santa Claus. And it was this complete flattening of the social hierarchy. And you would be with these people for hours doing whatever. And nobody was anybody. Everyone was Santa.
And so I really love the idea of these limnoid events. And so often what I write about are limnoid events where people have kind of invented another way of being within the world that they can go back to. The party crashing in Rant, mm-hmm. where people crash their cars in the streets consensually, is another limnoid event.
On another subject, I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about the origins of choke and, you know, the notion of what Victor actually ends up doing and how, you know, I guess, had you seen someone who had done that or the idea of faking choking, you know, and as a part of a con game?
The summer of 1999 was such a suck summer. Fight Club was supposed to be released early in the summer, but then I think it was the Columbine shootings happened, so they bumped the release date to October. And I was getting to be this media darling, and I was in the yard one day with the telephone doing all these phone interviews. And Time Magazine was supposed to call at 3 o'clock. The publicist said, Time Magazine is going to call. Make sure that you're free at 3. So I had the phone right there, and the phone rang, and it was the publicist. And she said, this might be a joke, but a police detective just called from Latah, Idaho. And they found a dead body, and they think it might be your father. So here's a phone number in Idaho. You need to call them back. And I called them back. And the next day I went up and identified my father's dead body. But it was such a strange, horrible juxtaposition of promoting the movie and having to do all of these very high-energy things, juxtaposed with going and getting my father's dental records and meeting with a medical examiner and looking at this very badly burned body to identify it. And the disconnect between the two, you know, very happy thing, very horrible thing. And one night I was driving back from one of these long trips to Idaho, and I was still dressed up. I was wearing a jacket and a tie, and I thought, I just can't take it. I am so exhausted. I so don't want to go on with my life. What I'm going to do is I'm going to pull over to the side of the road. There's not much traffic. And before another car comes, I'm going to walk a few steps up. I'm going to lie face down in the gravel with my headlights on me. And someone's going to come along and they're going to call the police and say somebody's collapsed on the road. And eventually I'm going to lay there in the dirt until somebody with a badge and a gun comes and puts two fingers against the side of my neck. And then very gently says, sir, are you okay? Sir, can you hear me? Can you tell me your name? Sir, and very gently kind of rolls me over and says, it's okay. It's all going to be okay. I so wanted that. I wanted somebody with authority to come and just touch me and say, it's going to be okay. And I did it. I pulled over. I walked ahead. I lay down in the dirt in my best clothes, and I waited. And I waited. And I waited. And nobody came along. And as I'm laying in the dirt, I thought, what about a guy who just pretends to choke in restaurants? So that somebody embraces him and seemingly saves his life. And he can have that breakdown in their arms while they're saying, you're going to be okay. Everything's all right. You're going to be okay. And eventually, I got up. I dusted myself off. I got back in the car and drove home, and I started writing Choke. But in a way, I come from a family where people really don't know how to express either their affection or their need for affection. So many of my books are people trying to fool each other into expressing affection or, you know, expressing it in very indirect ways. And so that's kind of par for the course. The guy going to the support groups to get hugged in Fight Club, the guy faking choking and choke, just all these ways of fooling people into meeting your emotional needs.
And there's a daughter who feigns her death in, it's in Diary, isn't it?
Right. She's kind of taken away from the mother.
Right.
As part of a conspiracy.
Right.
But the husband who has attempted suicide, who is in a coma,
right,
has sealed up all of these rooms and he's hidden all these messages. So again, it's a kind of suppressed indirect communication of something that can't be communicated directly.
We're going to be getting to your questions in about 5 minutes. So if you have one, write your name and questions on a question card on your seats or tweet them at inforumsf. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Amy Hempel, who is a very important writer to you and an important influence, but just about her work, you know, and what it's meant to you. Or if there are other writers too that you wanted to bring up, but I've read things that you've said specifically about her.
There are moments when your awareness of the world changes profoundly, just in an instant. And when I started in Tom Spanbauer's workshop, which was four people sitting around Tom's little kitchen table, and Tom gave us all a copy of The Harvest, a short story by Amy Hempel. And we read that story. And after that, 99.9% of fiction sucked. Our idea of how fantastic fiction could be was forever changed after that one story. We just could not go back and read a big, fat novel that kind of droned on and on when we'd seen Amy Hempel do something much more powerful in just 6 or 7 pages. And it was just amazing to see her do... tell a story without wordy transitions, without lots of setups, without any of these kind of conventional things. It just changed forever the way that we wrote.
And do you have a friendship with her at this point?
Yeah, we've gotten to be friends, acquaintances. She does. This is Amy. This is Amy in a nutshell. She does this volunteer work in Manhattan for an animal shelter. And the program is called Last Good Day. When a dog can't be adopted out, no one will take this dog. And it's about to be killed. On its last day, Amy Hempel takes it. She walks it all over Manhattan, and she feeds it everything it wants to eat, and she plays with it, and she gets it exhausted, because she knows that at the end of the day, the animal is going to get a shot and be killed. And because of budget cutbacks in this program, they're so afraid that that someone will hurt their back, that as they kill the dogs in the shelter, they give them the shot knowing that it will kill them within 30 seconds. And the last 30 seconds of these dogs' lives are they're forced to climb the pile of dead dogs that have been killed before them so that each dog dies at the top of the pile and no one has to carry it that far. So as the dog is dying, it's being led by the leash up the pile of dead dogs so that it will die at the top.
Lovely.
That's the kind of Amy Hempel detail that you'll never forget. Mm-hmm. It's just absolutely heartbreaking. And that, you know, that you can't go back after that. Makes that pile of tigers look pretty poignant.
Yes, I was thinking of those poor tigers. But these tigers are in a much more happy stage of their life. So now we're going to have Chuck's going to give us a short reading, and then we're going to have a giveaway, and then we'll do the audience questions. So.
God. I wish I could do guts. I would love to do guts. What I actually, there was one from last year, Romance, that's been made into a short film that comes out this fall at the Raindance Film Festival in London. And I thought about reading Romance. Would that be okay? Romance. You should congratulate me. My wife and I, we just had twins and they seem okay. 10 fingers, 10 toes, 2 little girls. But you know the feeling. I keep waiting for something to go wrong because that's how it is when things get too happy. I keep expecting to wake up from this beautiful dream. I mean, back before I was married, I had this one girlfriend who was fat. We were both of us fat together, so we got along. That girlfriend, she was always testing us on new diets to lose weight, like eating nothing except pineapple and vinegar, or nothing but green algae from an envelope. And she was suggesting that we take long walks together until she started to shed the pounds. Her hips just melted away. And you never saw anybody so happy. Even then, I knew something would wreck it. You know the feeling. When you love somebody, you're happy to see her happy. But I knew my girlfriend was going to dump me because now guys with careers and health insurance were getting her on their radar. I remember she was pretty and funny before, but now that she was getting so skinny, it was obvious that she possessed vast, untapped reserves of self-control and self-discipline way out of my league. And my friends weren't any help because they were all circling, waiting for us to call it quits so they could date her. And then it turned out it wasn't the pineapple or the self-discipline because she found out that she really had cancer. But she slimmed down to wearing a bitchin' hot size 2 just before she died. That's how I know happiness is like a ticking bomb. And how I met my wife is because I wasn't going to date anybody, not anymore, no way. So I was taking the Amtrak to Seattle. It was the year of Lollapalooza in Seattle, and I'd packed my tent and wrapped my sleeping bag to protect my bong so I could camp out all weekend, like a Grizzly Adams. And I walked into the bar car on the train. You know how sometimes you just need to leave the friends and the sobriety behind for a few days? I walked into the bar car and there's this total stone-cold fox pair of green eyes looking right directly at me. I'm not a monster. I'm not some reality show blimp stuck in a hospital bed eating buckets of fried chicken all day. But I can understand why guys would want to work as guards in women's prisons or concentration camps, where they could just date good-looking prisoners without those babes always saying, "Put a shirt on," and asking, "Do you always have to sweat so much?" But on the train, here is this goddess wearing a Radiohead t-shirt cut off to show her bare middle, and her jeans sagged down to where there ought to be bush showing. And she's wearing Mickey Mouse and Holly Hobby rings around every finger, holding a bottle, a beer to her beautiful lips and looking at me down the length of that brown bottle. Just an ordinary MGD, not some pussy microbrew in a green bottle. And guys like me, we know the score. Unless you are John Belushi or John Candy, no hottie is going to put you in that kind of an eye lock, so right away, I know enough to look away from her in shame. The only reason why a girl like her would talk to me is to break the news that I'm a gross fat pig and I'm blocking her entire view of the ocean. Know your limits, I always say. Aim low and you won't be disappointed. Edging past her, I look without looking. I check her out and she smells good, like some kind of dessert, like a baked pie, like a pumpkin pie with that red bread brown spices on top. Better yet, the beer bottle in her mouth turns to follow me as I walk down the aisle to to the bar and order a round, and it's not as if we're the last boy and girl in the whole world. A bunch of other people are drinking at their plastic tables, going to Lollapalooza from the look of their dreads and tie-dye. I walk all the way to the most faraway table from her, but this hottie watches me go all the way. You know the feeling when somebody's watching. You can't take one step without stumbling, especially on a moving around train. I go to take a drink as the train turns a corner. I spill some beer down my striped cowboy shirt. I'm pretending to watch the trees going by outside the window, but from a secret agent angle, I'm watching her reflection in the glass, and she's still watching me. The only time she looks away is when she steps up to the bar and gives the bartender some money, and he gives her another beer, and then her reflection is getting bigger and bigger until it's life-sized. And she's standing next to my table and says, "Hi," and something else, and I say, "What?" And she points at my cowboy shirt, at the beer spilled there, and she says, "I like your buttons. Shiny." I tuck my chin and look down at the pearl-colored snaps. They're not buttons, they're snaps. But I don't want to scotch this moment. And right from the get-go, I notice that she puts her fingers in her mouth sometimes. Okay, she puts her fingers in her mouth a lot. And she uses a breathy little girl voice with some baby talk words like basketti instead of spaghetti. And skizzers in place of scissors. But for a regulation hottie, that is just textbook being sexy. She gives me a wink and she licks the tip of her tongue around her lips, and with the wet still shining on them, she says, "I'm Britney Spears." She is such a tease. Sure, she's a little loaded, impaired. By now we're both drinking those little bottles of tequila, but it's not as if we're driving this train. No, she's not Britney Spears, but she is the same caliber of hot. It's clear that she's pulling my pud, but in a good way. And you just need to look at her to know all you need to know. The only chance I have is to hold on and keep flirting back and buying the drinks. She asks me where I'm headed, and I tell her Lollapalooza. She's walking her fingers up the front of my shirt, her fingertips stepping from snap to snap, from my belt up to my throat, then walking herself back down, and I'm hoping she can't feel how hard that makes my heart beat. And she is such a flirt, with her green eyes cutting from side to side or peeking up at me from under her long fluttering eyelashes. And she must be beers and beers ahead of me, because she keeps forgetting to end her sentences. And sometimes she points at something speeding by outside the window and she shouts, "A dog!" Or one time she sees a car waiting at a rail crossing, and Britt screams, "Slug bug!" and clobbers my shoulder with her fistful of Hello Kitty and Mickey Mouse rings, and secretly I hope I have the bruise for the rest of my life. And we go to Lollapalooza, and we pitch my tent. And Britt is so drunk that when she wakes up the next morning, she is still drunk. And no matter how much doobie I smoke, I'm having trouble keeping up. And maybe it's because Britt's so skinny, but she seems to cop a buzz without drinking for hours. Like maybe she's getting a contact high from my secondhand smoke. Our whole Lollapalooza is like the kind of beautiful, classic romance that you would pay to jerk off to on the internet. But it's happening to me. And we're dating for 6 months, all the way through Christmas, through Britt moving her stuff into my apartment. And I keep expecting Britt to wake up sober one morning. And she still hasn't. We go to eat Thanksgiving at my mom's house, and I have to explain. It's not that Britt is a finicky eater, but the reason she's so skinny is she only likes to eat a zucchini squash cut in half lengthwise and hollowed down the middle to make a miniature Iroquois dugout canoe with knife scratches on the outside to look like Indian writing, and a whole tribe of little braves carved out of raw carrot, but with green peas for their heads, lined up and rowing the war canoe across a dinner plate covered with a thick layer of chocolate syrup. And you'd be surprised how many restaurants don't have that particular item. Not on their regular menus. So most times Britt has to make it herself, and that takes half a day. And then she has to play with it on the living room carpet for an hour. And that's why she never seems to gain an ounce. And my mom? My mom's just stoked to see me dating again. And nothing you can smoke or shoot will ever get you as high as you will feel walking down the street holding hands with a supermodel, total stone-cold fox like my Brit. Guys driving down the street in their Ferrari Testarossa, guys with six-pack abs and steroid pecs. For the first time in my life, they have nothing over me. I am walking down the street with Brittany, and she is the prize that every guy is trying so hard to win. The only buzzkill is how every Romeo comes to sniff a circle around her, trying to grab her in an eye lock and giving her tits his best Pepsodent toothpaste smile. This one time, riding on a bus, a pack of Romeos stand themselves around Britt, where Britt and I are sitting in the back of the bus. Britt likes to sit on the aisle right over the back wheels so she can see to punch me first when there's a Volkswagen. And this one big Romeo comes to stand with his crotch situated at her eye level. And when the bus hits a pothole, maybe his hip brushes against her shoulder until Britt looks up at him. And talking around her fingers in her mouth, Brittany says, "Hello, big boy." And that's just how Britt can be. Friendly. And she winks and waves her wet fingers for the Romeo to lean down. And he looks around to make sure his competition is clocking his good luck. And this Romeo squats down to Britt's eye level, his face all bedroom smirk. And maybe because she's trying to make me jealous, Britt says to this Romeo, her smoking hot green eyes look at him, and she asks, "Do you want to see a magic trick?" And all the other Romeos perk up with looks that prove that they're all listening. And Britt takes her fingers out of her mouth, and she slides them down inside the front of her pants, grinding her wet fingers around inside the skin-tight crotch of her jeans. And the back half of our bus gets so quiet, with there watching her fingers wrestle behind her stonewashed denim zipper. And you can see these Romeos swallow their Adam's apples going up and down with all their extra spit and their eyes bulging like horny boners. And as fast as clobbering a slug bug, Brittany yanks something out of her pants and yells, "Magic trick!" She swings this thing shouting, "Puppet show!" And swinging from her hand is something on a little string. Like a tea bag, only bigger. It's like a hot dog bun, smeared with ketchup, swinging on a little string. And Brittany screams, "Puppet show! Magic trick!" And she smacks it across the cheek of this Romeo. Still squatting down next to her seat. And Britt chases after him, yelling and slapping his leather jacket with streaks of red. And the other Romeos not looking at her on purpose, fixing their faces to stare at their shoes or look out a window. She's swinging her little string to smack them upside their heads with red smears, the whole time squealing, "Puppet show! Magic trick!" Laughing, "Ha ha 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 ha!" Shouting, "Puppet show! Magic trick!" The bus is ding, ding, dinging for the next stop. And 100 people get off at the 7-Eleven. Pushing and stampeding like they all need to buy Slurpees. And I'm yelling after them, "It's okay, everybody." I'm yelling out the bus window, waving to get their attention. "She's a performance artist." I'm yelling, "She doesn't mean anything by it. It's just some gender politics deal." Even as the bus pulls away with just the two of us left on board, I'm yelling, "She's just a free spirit." And one night, I come home from work and Britt is naked and standing sideways to the bathroom mirror, holding her belly in both hands. And since we met on the train, she's gained a little weight. But it's nothing that a couple weeks worth of pineapple and vinegar won't fix. And Brittany takes my hand and holds my fingers spread against her belly and she says, "Feel." She says, "I think I ate a baby." And she looks at me like a puppy dog with her green, haughty eyes, and I ask if she wants me to go with her to the clinic and take care of it. And she nods her head, yes. So we go on my day off, and there's the usual Sunday school teachers blocking the sidewalk. They hold a garbage bag full of nothing but broke-up plastic baby doll arms and heads mixed together with ketchup. And Britt doesn't hesitate. She reaches into their bag and she takes out a leg and she licks it clean like a French fry. And that's how cool my beautiful girlfriend is. And I open a National Geographic magazine while the nurse asks her if she's eaten anything today, and Britt says she ate a whole canoe full of Iroquois warriors the day before. But no, she hasn't eaten anything yet today. And I haven't finished reading this one article about ancient Egyptian mummies before there's a scream and Brittany comes running out of the back still wearing a paper dress and bare feet. Like this is a big deal, like maybe she's never had an abortion before. Because she runs barefoot all the way back to my apartment. And to make her stop shaking and throwing up, I have to ask her to marry me. And it's obvious my friends are insanely jealous because they throw me this bachelor party. And when Brittany goes to the ladies' room all bummed out because the chef won't carve her a war canoe, my so-called friends, they all look at me and they say, "Dude, she is the total most hot, best thing ever. But we don't think she's stoned." My best friends, they say, "You didn't marry her yet, did you?" And their faces don't say that Britt being knocked up is good news. And you know the feeling. You want your best friends and your fiancé to mesh, but my friends, they grit their teeth and they look at me with their eyebrows worried together in the middle. And they say, "Dude, did it ever cross your mind that maybe, just maybe, Brittany is mentally retarded?" And I tell him to relax. She's just an alcoholic. I'm pretty certain that she's a heroin junkie too. That, and she is a sexual compulsive. But it's nothing so bad that some talk therapy won't fix her. "Look at me," I say. "I'm fat. Nobody's perfect. And maybe instead of a wedding reception, we could get our two families together in a hotel conference room and surprise her with an intervention. And instead of a honeymoon, we could get Brittany committed to a 90-day inpatient recovery program. We'll work through this. That's what marriage is about." But no way is she retarded. She just needs some rehab. It's obvious that they're only bad-mouthing Brittany because they are actually totally Romeo Boner, insanely jealous. The minute I looked the other way, they would be so up in her business. They say, dude, they say, don't look now, but you fucked a retard. And that's how unpopular I am, that I have to settle for these shitty friends. Brit, they insist. They say Brit has the intellect of a six-year-old. They think they're doing me a favor when they tell me, dude, she can't love you because she doesn't have the capacity. Like the only way somebody would ever marry me is if she had irreparable brain damage. And I tell them, she can't be retarded for crying out loud because she wears a pink thong. And it has to be love because every time we're together, I come so hard my stomach hurts. And it's like I told my mom's boyfriend at Thanksgiving, no, Brit is not a high-functioning anything. My best guess is she's an alcoholic, glue-sniffing, dope-shooting slut. But we're working on getting her into treatment after she has the babies. And maybe she's a nymphomaniac, but what's important here is that she is my nymphomaniac. And that drives my family crazy with envy. I tell them, I'm in love with the beautiful, sex-crazed slut. So why can't you just be happy for me? And after all that fuss, there's a lot less people at our wedding than you might expect. And it could be that love makes you prejudiced, but I always thought that Brit was pretty smart. You know the feeling when you can watch TV together for a whole year and you both never argue over what shows? Seriously, if you knew how much TV we watch every week, you would call us a happy marriage. And now I have two little babies who smell like Thanksgiving pies. And when they're old enough, I'm going to tell my two little girls that everybody looks a little crazy if you're looking close enough. And if you can't look that close, then you don't really love them. And all the while, your life goes around, and 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 your life goes around. And if you keep waiting for somebody perfect, then you will never find love, because it's how much you love them is what makes them perfect. And maybe I'm the retarded one, because I keep waking up expecting my happiness to just run out when I should just enjoy it. Being this crazy, in love, happy simply cannot be so easy. And I can't expect such total happiness to last the rest of my life. And there's got to be something wrong with me if I love my wife so much. And for right now, I'm driving my new family home from the hospital with my beautiful wife sitting next to me and our twin baby girl safe in the back seat. But I'm still worried how happiness this great can't last forever when Brittany screams, slug bug, and her fist clobbers my shoulder so hard I almost crash this into a whole Dairy Queen. That was romance.
Yeah. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to have a giveaway, right? And then we're going to take some questions from the audience.
Sure.
So, okay.
So,
do you need my assistance in the tiger?
I think there is going to be a tiger runner.
Okay.
So, some good trivia questions. What is the safe word?
Poodle.
Who said poodle first? I think I heard over here first. It was Rusty, right? Rocky. Rocky gets the poodle. Okay. Fill in the blank. It's seeing that blank that saved my life. Close. Seeing that blank that saved my life. Okay. Vitamin. It's seeing that vitamin pill that saved my life. What is it that Brandy Alexander cannot stand the feel of?
Cotton balls.
It's a tough one. It's a really tough one. No. No, it's just when you can feel the stem in the martini glass. So. Oh, what does Premarin stand for? Okay, I saw a hand and heard it. So the hand gets it. With the glasses? Yeah. Okay. In Haunted, in one of the stories towards the end about the end of the world, there's a Boston Terrier. What is its name? What? You already have a tiger. I heard one over here. Okay, everybody's pointing back there, so I can't believe you got that one. Shit. The Testicle Festival is held in what town in... No, that's it. One town. Small... It's near Missoula. Is not Missoula. I heard it. No, I heard it. Did you say it again? Clinton. Clinton, Montana. So, she said it. So somebody else said it. Okay. So if you get the tiger back to the... Please.
All right, so this is from the audience, and I'd like the person to stand when I... as we ask the question. So this is from Nicole Vargas. Would you like to remix any of your other books? Which ones and why?
Nicole.
So Nicole. Nicole, can you... And she get... Well, you'll get a tiger, right?
So, yes. Yeah. No, you know, that's really the only one that I would have done this with. I got my way with pretty much everything else. So.
Okay. This is by Melinda. It says 26 and a half years old. Melinda, could you half stand up? Yeah. So, for your tiger. If you could switch worlds with any of your characters for a day, who would it be and why? Any character from any book?
You know, Adia, I really like the sweet, innocent characters. So, you know, the guy in the romance story, Denny and Choke, that kind of the character that doesn't read things into things, who's just able to take things as they occur. I wish I could be more of that character. So I don't want to be Tyler Durden. I want to be Denny.
This is from Chelsea Lauderdale. Chelsea, stand up for your tiger. She says, P.S., you are my hero. And she says, do you have a favorite quote or scene from Invisible Monsters? If so, what is it?
From Invisible Monsters. Oh, the scene, kind of a reoccurring scene where they're watching their childhood home movies projected on the side of their white trailer house. Because years ago, I went to visit a friend, Dave Pinson, in Idaho, out in the Idaho prairies. And Dave had a porn movie, and we didn't have a movie screen. So we ran this porn movie on the side of his parents' trailer house. And that was a kind of a penultimate Idaho experience, watching porn on the side of a trailer house.
This is from Adam Hyde. Adam? And he asks, stand for your tiger. What advice can you give young artists with writer's block?
Actually, no. No. If you've got one aspect of a story that is really good, taking that aspect to a party to see if it resonates with people. Because I find that the stories that, the great, great stories are not the stories that shut people down, that make everybody go, ooh. But the stories that excite everyone to tell their version of the story are the stories that just kind of explode a room. And so if you can really develop a theme by taking the one part of your story that really works to a party and telling it, and then you get everyone else's version of that. I'm trying to think of a better example. For a long time, my best examples were the kind of workplace hazing stories that I collect. I love these stories. When I started working at Freightliner, my job after college, on the assembly line building Freightliner trucks, my first day, my foreman told me to go to another workstation and get their squeegee sharpener. So I get sent to this other dirty man who spits all over me and cusses me out and sends me to another dirty man who spits all over me and cusses me. And by the end of the day, the only thing I learn is that there is no such thing as a squeegee sharpener. And I've introduced myself to every foreman that I might possibly ever work for in this plant. I take that story to a party and tell it, and people would go, oh my gosh, me too. I worked at Target, and on your first day, they send you to get the shelf stretchers. Or I worked at TGI Fridays, and your first day, they send you to find the banana peeler. And I would take these stories, and they would just, I would get hundreds of examples. One guy in Toronto said, I worked in a brickworks. On your first day, they give you a bucket, and they tell you to get a bucket full of hot steam and bring it back. And you get this, and you end up really burned badly because you're trying to hold this hot bucket. And every once in a while, you'll see someone running around with a bucket upside down. Mm-hmm. And you realize it's their first day. And people would tell me the most appalling, appalling stories. Doctors have incredible, horrible stories. But if you have one part of the story, one part of what you're working on that works beautifully, take it to a party and see if it resonates with people. See if it generates something from their experience that makes a better example of that, that will kind of help develop and flesh out the theme that you're exploring. Don't work from just your own experience. Feel free to exploit everyone around you.
So that everybody here can exploit you, the question is from Camille Brittany, and she asks, can you describe your wildest night ever? Camille, can you stand up?
No, I can't.
No more of them.
No, that is since I discovered Ambien. That is really sucky because you know you had a great time and you just wake up with clues. I went to Alaska to do a book event, and the flight got in really late, and I'm standing in line to check in at the Hilton with all the people who were on the same flight, and I took an Ambien in this long line of people. I wasn't sleepy. I took another one. By the time I checked in, I'd taken 3 Ambien. I got to my room 1 o'clock in the morning. No room service. I was starving. I woke up the next morning, and there were all over the bed pieces of bread covered in mayonnaise and mustard. And I had a really vague idea, this dream of sitting in bed and pulling apart dozens of sandwiches and just eating the meat out of the sandwich. And I said, "Did I order a bunch of sandwiches?" And they said, "No, sir, room service stops at midnight. But you did come down to the bar." I said, "Was I wearing any clothes?" They said, "You were wearing briefs." I went down to the bar, full of people, at 1:30 in the morning in Anchorage, Alaska. And I walked down 24 flights of the stairs in my underwear. I said, "Did I buy sandwiches?" They said, "You bought every pre-made sandwich we had." And I carried all these sandwiches back up to my room.
This question is from Lulu Ekparian. Lulu, where are you, Lulu? And she asks, "What are some influences for the darkness in your books? Horror films, death metal music, interest in monsters, zombies, traumatic memory events, or just pure imagination?"
Boy. You know, when I was little, boy, I hated this. When I was little, every once in a while, I would be sent to the school office to run an errand or something. And there was a big poster in the school office. It had a Volkswagen Bug kind of driving out of the frame. It had a surfboard strapped to the top of the Bug and these little cartoon blips of smoke coming out of the tailpipe. And the poster said in these big cheerful letters, "Before you leave on summer vacation and have the time of your life, don't forget to register for the draft." And it was synonymous with turn 18 and die, because it was Vietnam. And everybody in our little town, it was like, that was just it. Turn 18 and die. The poster might as well just say that. Before you have a great time this summer, die. And nobody ever talked about it, but all my friends had that same terror. Just 18 years old meant die. Die. You're going to die. And it was this horrible shadow hanging over us, because we thought that Vietnam, it had gone on throughout all of our childhood. We thought it would never go away. Everybody else in our community, this little farm town, it was, "Go to Vietnam, don't come back." But when the Vietnam War ended, it was fantastic. And I thought, wow, you know, life is just going to be great. And then, AIDS. Fucking AIDS. Turn 18 and die. It's always just after that, just one fucked up, threatening, horrible thing after another. And there's just got to be some way to be with that. And I talked to Max Brooks a lot about this, the man who wrote World War Z. And he said that the zombie thing is just a metaphor for dealing with this overload of every week being shown some new thing that's going to kill you, that you have no power against. And that we have to create these sort of metaphors, these kind of ways of being with these constant state of threat and panic. And so my job as a reporter, as a curious person, is to always go out and try to find mastery of the scary thing. You know, when the medical examiner said, you don't want to see pictures of your father's body, it's too upsetting. I said, okay, I've got to see these pictures. And when my mother was dying of cancer, I knew I had to be there and take care of her. And so I was there the morning she died. I called all my siblings. I said, she's dead. You know, I cannot look away from these things. I worked in a big AIDS hospice for people in poverty in Portland. That's how I started writing Fight Club. Is I would take them. I couldn't do it. I had no nursing skills, so I would be what they called an escort. And I would take them to their support group meetings, and I would kind of sit on the edges. And people would assume that since I was in the meeting, I also had AIDS. And so they would pull me into the group. And there was no diplomatic way of saying, just hanging out. So I had to start making a story in my head. What if I was a guy just going to these groups? Because, boy, when I wasn't in those groups, my shitty life on the Freightliner assembly line looked fantastic. It was great. And so, in a way, the darkness in my stories is always kind of a coping narrative, a way of being with the intolerable, the thing that I cannot resolve and I cannot be with. I have to create a kind of a story that disempowers it. With every single one of those things. Oh.
So we are at it's a one-hour event. We're at the 1 hour and 20-minute mark. So we're going to ask one more question, and then we'll have to figure out a method to get rid of the rest of the tigers after that.
You have everyone. You have your balloons. You still have balloons. Okay. So
the last question was. This is from Sarah Denning and Joseph Turner, so that's two tigers on this one. What was the inspiration behind Waitansi Island in Diary?
The Waitansi Island was based on all those really small towns that I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and how so many of those are getting very wealthy people moving in who are retiring and making vineyards and kind of upsetting the whole power structure of each of the towns. And so it was really just based on these sleepy little farm towns that are now becoming kind of vineyard hotbeds and cultural hotspots. So that's the very unglamorous answer to that. So.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club Inforum. Connect your intellect. So I guess we'll wind down now. Do you have something to do with the balloons now?
Yes.
Okay.
And this will make sense next year. But this is a balloon baby. It has a head, two arms, and two legs. If you can make the first however many balloon babies, you get a tiger. This is also a balloon baby. Again, a head, two arms, and two legs.
So, why don't you grab some tigers and we'll wait out and give them out as people get them.
Okay.
Show me a baby.
So what are
Come
they
on,
supposed
make
to look
a baby.
Like in order to get...
Is that a baby? Yeah. I think you have one.
So you can hand out tigers to people who have good ones.
That's not a baby.
The ones who have like elaborate balloons.
Two arms, two legs, a head. Two arms, two legs, a head. Almost. You're so close. That's not a baby.
Okay. It's a tiger.
No. Come on. Oh, almost. Almost. What's that? No, not right now. Okay.
A balloon aboard ship.
That's just sick.
Here you go.
Can I get a quick picture?
In a minute. Oh, you got a trailer? Okay.
Okay. Yes.
Can I have one today for my birthday?
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
Whoa, that's really good. I'll give you a tiger.
You gotta make an attempt here.
I gotta get the tigers out first. Oh, that's
what?
That's good. That's good.
That's you wrote, a baby. Didn't get out.
That's good. That's good.
You're struggling here.
Hey, not all babies are created equal.
That's it. I'm sorry. That's all the tigers I got.
Better make it.
Really quick.
All right. You've done it.
We have to complete.
Here you go.
Oh, thank you.
All right. The tigers. The tigers are gone. Sorry. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club.
Yeah, we're not done yet. I need to finish the script.
Thank you for coming out tonight.
We need to finish the script. Yeah.
Have a good night. Thank you.
Shake my hand.
Yeah.
Thank you. I have. I'm sorry. I have.
All right. So, hello, everybody.
Lori Nataro.
In closing.
Okay.
You would enjoy it.
All right, so not the question.
Thank you.
All right, so let's give a big round of applause to Chuck Palahniuk for sharing his thoughts with us tonight. And this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.